Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Okay, so let's think about a really complex disease, maybe something like ulcerative colitis. We know genetics plays a huge part, right?
Absolutely, a massive role.
But here's the weird thing. What if only a really tiny number of genes are directly causing the problems, and like the vast majority are influencing things indirectly?
Like a ripple effect.
Exactly. Creating this huge ripple effect across the whole genome. How does that even work? How do all those indirect genes team up? And why do they account for like a whopping 70% of a trait's heritability? That seems huge.
It is huge. And it's a central question in genomics right now.
So this hidden genetic architecture, that's what we're diving into today. How could figuring this out change how we understand, maybe even treat, things like autoimmune disorders or heart disease?
The implications are potentially enormous.
And I hear things get really wild when genes interact, like 1 + 1 suddenly doesn't equal 2 anymore.
And definitely. We'll get into that. It gets very nonlinear very quickly.
Okay, fascinating. So today we're looking at a really groundbreaking study. It's by Florin Rotazek, Matthias Heinig, and Pascal Falterbraun. Just came out September 4th, 2025, in the American Journal of Human Genetics.
Yes, really fresh research.
And their team, mostly based at the Helmholtz Center Munich, they've done some incredible work here, really pushing our understanding of how genes fit together in complex traits.
They really have. They've tackled this concept of the omnigenic architecture,
which is basically the big blueprint, like how all our genes, the main ones and the supporting ones, interact to influence disease.
That's a good way to think about it, the grand blueprint. And to help us unpack all of this, I'm here to guide us through it. So, you know, one of the big challenges we've had with genome-wide association studies, GWAS.
Right, GWAS, we talk about those a lot. They find genetic regions linked to diseases.
Exactly. They tell us where to look. They pinpoint these genetic variations linked to traits. But the problem is, they often don't tell us how those specific variations actually, mechanistically, lead to what we see, the phenotype.
Ah, okay. So GWAS gives us the address, maybe the street name.
Precisely. It gives us a where, but not always the how or the why. It matters on a, you know, functional level.
So if GWAS finds the dodgy street, what's the omnigenic model trying to figure out? Like, what's happening inside the houses, the neighborhood vibe?
That's a great analogy. The omnigenic model tries to bridge exactly that gap. It suggests there's a small group of genes, let's call them core genes.
The main players.
The main players, exactly. They have a direct effect on the trait. They're like the command center. And you'd expect them to be super important, maybe intolerant to mutations that break them, what we call loss of function mutations.
Okay.
And they should be active in the tissues that are relevant to the disease. But here's the really interesting part. The vast majority of genes, the peripheral genes.
The supporting cast.
Yeah, the entire supporting cast. They act indirectly. They influence those core genes. But through these really intricate molecular networks, it's all about how that supporting cast works together to influence the key players.
That makes a lot of sense. So it's this whole interconnected system. And the study we're looking at today focused on ulcerative colitis UC, right, as their main example.
That's right. UC was their primary case study.
And UC is, well, it's an autoimmune disease, affects the bowel, seems to be getting more common too.
It is. It's a type of inflammatory bowel disease, increasingly widespread. And crucially for this model, UC has really high heritability. Twin studies estimated around 0.67.
Wow, so genetics is definitely a big factor.
A very significant factor. But here's the puzzle. The known genetic markers from GWAS, they only explain about 40% of that heritability.
So there's a big chunk missing, the missing heritability problem.
Exactly, a significant gap. And the hope is that the omnigenic model, by looking at this broader network, might help explain some of that missing piece. UC itself involves a dysregulated immune response.
Right, the immune system attacking the body's own tissues, often triggered by gut bacteria.
Precisely. You get increased pro-inflammatory signaling, think molecules like NF-kappa-B and TNF-alpha, major drivers of inflammation. And you see immune cells, lymphocytes, infiltrating the gut tissue.
Okay, so it's a real perfect storm of immune activity going wrong. Understanding the full genetic picture sounds critical.
Absolutely. And to get a handle on this complexity, the researchers used a pretty sophisticated tool, a graph machine learning framework called SPEOS.
SPEOS, okay, what does that do?
It's specifically designed to identify these core genes, What it does is it integrates loads of different types of biological data, and it learns by looking at genes we already know cause diseases when mutated these Mendelian disorder genes, like from the OMEN database.
Ah, so it learns from clear examples of main players.
You got it. It learns the patterns, the network context, how these known core genes interact with other genes and proteins, where they're expressed, things like that.
So it's like teaching an AI to spot star players by showing it lots of MVP highlights, and then it goes looking for new potential stars based on how they play and connect with the team.
That's a really good analogy, actually. Speos then predicts new potential core genes and gives them a score, a consensus score, or CS, from 0 to 11.
Higher score means more likely to be a core gene.
Exactly. Higher score, higher confidence. So for this study, they define core genes as those known Mendelian ones plus the new predictions with the top score, CS 11. And genes scoring 0 were considered peripheral.
Okay. And what kind of data did they feed into Speos? You said diverse data types.
Well, a huge amount.
Yeah.
They built this massive network map connecting over 17,000 genes and proteins with about 4.1 million connections, or edges.
Wow. What kind of connections are we talking about? Genes physically bumping into each other, sending signals?
Both and more. They included direct physical interactions between proteins, PPIs, protein-protein interactions. They looked at genetic regulation, how transcription factors and enhancers control gene activity using data from dozens of healthy human tissues. They also included metabolic interactions, genes involved in the same chemical pathways. And on top of all that network data, they layered in the GWS results, those association signals, plus incredibly detailed information on where genes are switched on or off gene expression data from 72 different human tissues and 18 types of blood cells.
That is an incredible amount of information to integrate. It sounds almost overwhelming.
It's a massive data set, really trying to capture the complexity.
But with machine learning, sometimes it feels a bit like a black box, doesn't it? You put data in, get an answer out, but you don't know why the model decided what it did. Did they look inside the box?
That's a critical point, and they addressed it. They used a technique called integrated gradients.
Integrated gradients.
Yeah. It's a method that helps you interpret these complex models. It essentially assigns important scores to the different inputs, like a specific network connection or gene expression in a particular tissue.
So it's like shining a spotlight inside the black box to see what bits of data the AI actually thought were most important for making its prediction.
Exactly. It helps reveal the reasoning behind the prediction. Which piece of information really swayed the decision.
Okay, that's clever. And they didn't just look at static maps, right? They looked at genes in action.
Right. They used perturbation experiments. There's a large data set called LINCS, which shows what happens to gene expression across many cell types when you specifically knock down or ramp up the activity of individual genes.
So you poke one gene and see how the others react.
Pretty much. And they looked for what they called discriminative perturbigens. These are genes where tweaking their activity caused the core genes to respond significantly differently than the peripheral genes did. A way to see if core genes react as the coordinated group.
That's a really powerful way to see the network effects. But, you know, in our bodies, it's rarely just one gene being tweaked, is it? We usually have multiple genetic variations working together.
You're absolutely right. And that's a major challenge. So they took another step, co-perturbation simulations.
Co-perturbation. So simulating poking multiple genes at once.
Precisely. They used another deep learning model, this one called GEARS, which is designed to simulate the effects of combinations of gene perturbations.
Ah, okay. Because the combined effect might not just be the sum of the parts.
Exactly. This is where it gets really interesting, as you mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm.
GEARS can help detect if the combined effect is, say, suppression, meaning the result is weaker than just adding up the individual effects.
Like 1 plus 1 equals 1.5?
Sort of, yeah. Or it could be neomorphism.
Neomorphism sounds fancy.
It just means a totally new, unexpected effect that you wouldn't predict from the individual changes, something nonlinear.
Okay, here's where it gets really mind-bending. It's not just 1 plus 1 equals 2 anymore. So after all this sophisticated analysis, uncovering the potential for these really complex interactions, what did they actually find? What did this tell them about the omnigenic architecture of UC?
Well, first off, Speos did its job. It confidently identified 693 core genes for ulcerative colitis. That includes the known Mendelian genes plus those high-confidence CS11 predictions.
Okay, nearly 700 core genes. And were they actually relevant to UC?
Yes, strongly so. They validated them. These core genes were significantly enriched for causing disease-related symptoms when knocked out in mice. They also showed different expression levels in actual UC patients compared to healthy controls. And they generally had stronger signals than the original GWAS data, too.
So the model picked out genes that genuinely seemed to matter for UC. But what made these specific genes stand out as core compared to all the others?
Okay, this is one of the key findings. Tissue specificity was critical. For these UC core genes, being highly expressed, highly active in disease-relevant tissues was a major predictor.
Which tissues specifically? The colon, I assume.
Well, yes and no. They found strong links to immune system tissues. The spleen, whole blood, and certain types of immune cells called EBV-transformed lymphocytes. But here's a twist.
Uh-oh. Surprise.
A bit of one. While UC primarily hits the colon, the model also highlighted gene expression in the terminal ileum, that's the last part of the small intestine.
That isn't expected. The small intestine isn't the main site of UC inflammation.
Right. But this finding has actually popped up in other studies too, and what it does is really drive home the autoimmune nature of UC. It suggests the immune system itself is the primary driver, the real conductor of the disease, and the colon is where the effects manifest strongly. Maybe even more critical than the affected organ itself.
Wow, okay. That's a really important distinction. Thinking of the immune system as the conductor, how does that change things practically?
Well, it strongly suggests that therapeutic strategies really need to focus on modulating the immune system. That's likely where the core action is happening. And this pattern contrasted sharply with what they called highly significant peripheral genes, or HSPs.
HSP is peripheral genes, but with strong GUAS signals.
Exactly. These HSPs, despite showing up strongly in GUAS, didn't have that same tissue-specific expression pattern. They were more uniformly expressed across different tissues. For them, the main reason the model predicted them was simply their strong GWAS association score.
Can you give an example?
Sure. There's a gene called INAVA. It's involved in innate immunity, so it sounds relevant. But its expression is mainly in goblet cells, the cells that produce mucus in the gut lining, not directly in the immune cells themselves. This points to a more indirect role, influencing the environment perhaps, rather than directly driving the core immune dysfunction.
I see. So the core genes are active in the immune command centers, while some strong peripheral signals might be from genes acting elsewhere, but still influencing the process. These core genes really start to paint a picture of what's going wrong, don't they? What functions did they find were associated with them?
Unsurprisingly, they were heavily enriched in functions related to the immune system and inflammation. Things like pro-inflammatory signaling pathways, processes involved in T-cell migration, how cells respond to bacterial molecules. All hallmarks of UC.
Makes sense. Anything else?
Yes. Interestingly, they also saw enrichment for pathways involving vitamin A and vitamin D.
Which are known to modulate the immune system, right?
Exactly. And also pathways related to angiogenesis, the growth of new blood vessels, which is important for healing the damaged gut lining. So it's a mix of driving the inflammation and pathways involved in trying to control or repair it.
Okay. So we have core genes, their functions, their tissue specificity. What about how they connect to each other and the rest of the network?
This was another really interesting finding. Across all three diseases, they looked at in detail UC, coronary artery disease, CAD, and schizophrenia, SCZ.
Oh, they looked beyond UC.
Yes, they applied the same framework to CAD and schizophrenia to see if the principles held up. And one thing stood out universally, protein-protein interactions, PPIs.
Direct physical connections between proteins.
Yes. These PPIs were consistently flagged as highly important network connections in all three diseases. It suggests that these direct physical interactions are fundamentally crucial for how these core gene networks operate, regardless of the specific disease.
But surely there are differences between the diseases.
Oh, absolutely. There were distinct network flavors. For UC, as we said, the most important connections involve PPIs and regulatory links in blood and spleen immune tissues.
Yeah.
For CAD, coronary artery disease.
Heart disease. Probably involves metabolism.
You nailed it. For CAD, there was a clear overrepresentation of metabolic connections.
Mm-hmm.
For example, interactions involving proteins like APOE and APOC1, which are key players in transporting fats and are linked to atherosclerosis.
That makes perfect sense. It really underscores how CAD is tied up with the body's metabolism, not just the heart muscle itself. How did that compare to schizophrenia?
Schizophrenia showed yet another pattern. There, they found an overrepresentation of regulatory connections active in the adrenal gland involved in stress response and also in tissues that have significant contact with microbes, like the colon, esophagus, even the vagina.
Interesting. Hinting at potential links between the brain, stress, and maybe the microbiome.
It certainly raises those questions. And another exciting outcome here is that many of the specific PPIs the model highlighted as important. Well, they haven't really been studied in detail yet.
So it's pointing towards new research avenues, uncharted territory.
Exactly. A whole set of new potential targets or mechanisms to investigate.
That's fantastic. Now, you mentioned earlier these perturbation experiments, poking one gene and seeing the effect. How widespread were those effects on the core genes?
This was one of the most striking findings, I think. They found that an astounding one-third of all the gene perturbations they tested, whether knocking a gene down or boosting it, caused a discriminative change in the UC core genes.
One-third. So messing with almost any random gene in the genome has a noticeable specific impact on the core UC genes as a group.
Pretty much. It means the core genes, as a collective, responded differently than peripheral genes or random gene sets did to a huge number of different perturbations.
Wow. So it's like almost any tweak anywhere in the system sends ripples that are specifically felt by the core command center.
That's the implication. And this concerted perturbation response wasn't just a UC thing. They saw similar patterns for the core genes identified for CAD and schizophrenia too. It suggests this might be a general property core genes sit at such a central point in the network that they feel the effects of changes happening almost anywhere else.
That's incredible network sensitivity.
It is. Now, while the rate of this effect was consistent, the specific genes that caused the biggest ripples, the perturbigans, did vary depending on the cell type they tested in.
Okay, so the specific pathways involved depend on the context.
Right. But interestingly, related diseases like UC and another autoimmune condition, rheumatoid arthritis, tended to share more similar perturbigans, suggesting overlapping network vulnerabilities.
That makes biological sense.
And one more point on complexity. They also found that these core genes tend to have more regulatory switches, more transcription start sites, more active enhancer elements, indicating they're under more complex control themselves.
Okay, so they're sensitive hubs, and they're also intricately regulated. Now, let's get back to that nonlinear surprise, the co-perturbations. What happened when they simulated changing two genes at once?
Right. This is where the picture gets even more complex and really refines that omnigenic model. When they simulated perturbing two or more UC core genes simultaneously, they frequently saw genetic interactions that were not just simple addition.
Okay, break it down. What kind of interactions?
They saw suppression. That's where the combined effect was actually weaker than you'd expect by just adding the individual effects together.
So 1 plus 1 equals, say, 1.5 again.
Something like that. For instance, they mentioned NAKB1 and MAP2K3. Both are involved in the immune response to bacteria. If you activate both, maybe they partly saturate the same downstream pathway, so the combined inflammatory signal isn't double, it's less than double.
Okay, suppression. What else?
Neomorphism. This is where the combined effect was substantially different, a qualitatively new outcome, not just stronger or weaker.
Like 1 plus 1 equals orange.
Huh. Maybe not orange, but definitely something unexpected based on the individual effects. They gave an example of BAX and NFKBIA. Both involved in programmed cell death, or apoptosis. Overexpressing both together might trigger a much more drastic cellular response, maybe a switch to a different state that you wouldn't see by perturbing just one of them.
Wow. If we thought the system was complex before, adding these nonlinear interactions, it just got a whole lot more nuanced, didn't it?
It absolutely did.
Yeah.
It's not just about what each gene does alone. It's critically about how they behave together. That's a huge shift in perspective, potentially.
It really is. And did this apply just to core interactions?
Interestingly, no. They also predicted that those highly significant peripheral genes, the HSPs, would show strong interactions with core genes during these co-perturbations. That seemed to differentiate them from other less significant peripheral genes.
Okay, so this adds a whole new layer. Thinking about all these findings together, what does this mean for the omnigenic model we started with? Has this study changed it?
I'd say it provides really strong empirical backing for some of the model's key ideas. Specifically, that core genes often show tissue-specific expression relevant to the disease, and that peripheral genes exert this widespread, coordinated influence on them. That seems well supported now.
But it adds something new, too.
Critically, yes. It adds this layer of frequent nonlinear interactions, especially among core genes, the suppression and neomorphism. The idea that the combined impact isn't just additive significantly refines the model. It makes explaining complex traits potentially even more challenging, but also more realistic.
And for ulcerative colitis specifically, what are the big takeaways?
It strongly reinforces the view of UC as fundamentally an immune-driven disease. The fact that core gene activity is so centered on immune tissues like the spleen and blood helps explain why the disease manifests in the colon, perhaps as an over-the-top immune response to the gut environment. And as we said, this really guides where to look for therapeutic targets.
It feels like this opens up so many new questions. What about those peripheral master regulators that the original omnigenic model proposed single peripheral genes that have a big impact?
That's a great question. This study found that the first part, having a concerted influence on core genes, seems surprisingly common. Lots of genes can ripple effects towards the core.
Oh, okay.
But for a peripheral gene to really act like a master regulator and show up strongly in GWAS, the core genes it influences probably also need to have a shared direction of effect on the actual disease trait. And these nonlinear interactions we just discussed, they make predicting that shared effect much, much harder.
So it's not enough to just influence the core genes. You have to influence them in a way that consistently pushes the disease risk up or down. And the nonlinear effects mess with that consistency.
Exactly. It might be why finding these really impactful peripheral master regulators with strong GWAS signals is still relatively rare. You need that perfect storm. Coordinated influence, shared direction of effect, and the gene probably can't be under such strong negative selection that the variation gets eliminated. It's a high bar.
That makes a lot of sense. So, stepping back, why should someone listening, maybe not a specialist geneticist, why should you care about this deep dive into omnigenic architecture?
Well, because understanding these incredibly complex genetic networks is fundamental to tackling complex diseases, the ones that affect most people, like heart disease, diabetes, autoimmune disorders, psychiatric conditions. Getting a better handle on this architecture has really profound implications for how we might diagnose these conditions earlier, predict risk more accurately, prevent them, and ultimately develop much more effective, perhaps personalized treatments. It's moving us towards a deeper, more mechanistic understanding.
Okay, so wrapping this up, if I had to summarize our deep dive today, it sounds like core genes for diseases like UC are really sitting at the heart of our biological networks. They're strongly tied to specific tissues relevant to the disease, like immune tissues for UC. And maybe surprisingly, most other genes, even way out on the periphery, seem to exert some kind of coordinated influence on these core players.
That's a good summary.
And this is the real kicker. When these genes act together, especially the core genes, their combined effects often aren't simple addition. You get suppression, where the effect is dampened, or even entirely new interactions popping up neomorphism.
Precisely. And this significantly refines that omnigenic model. It reveals this crucial layer of nonlinear complexity, showing how genetic variation actually translates into disease risk in a way that's much more intricate than we might have thought. It really forces us to move beyond thinking about genes just one by one.
Which leads to the final thought.
What does this added complexity, this nonlinear, truly mean for how we approach developing personalized treatments?
Yeah.
Especially for diseases where potentially thousands of genes contribute in these incredibly intricate, often unforeseen interacting ways. How do we target a network, not just a single gene?
A challenging question to leave us with. Thank you for unpacking that complex study. This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, base by base.